my real aspiration is to be someone who helps bring us back to a middle place where we are all pushing to make sure we capitalize on the benefits of technology, which are still there and they're essential if we're going to be solving the problems in the 21st century. But we have to simultaneously figure out how do we protect against all of those downside risks. And that's the trick.
Hi, everyone. I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. Each week, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lenses of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. In our first episode, we heard from Peggy Hicks at the office of the UN High Commissioner on Human Rights and Danish Tech Ambassador Anne-Marie Engtoft-Larsen. We chatted about what tech diplomacy is and how governments around the world are creating new diplomatic structures like tech ambassadors, and using old ones like the United Nations to grapple with tech issues. This week, we're digging even deeper into tech diplomacy. What exactly is tech diplomacy? Why is it needed? And more importantly, how can we achieve it? We'll be chatting with two women who are at the forefront of pushing for a more diplomatic approach to tech policy. First, we hear from Eileen Donahoe, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, and now an important voice in Silicon Valley on tech issues. Then we'll hear from Maricha Shakta, who was a leading advocate for tech policy in the European Parliament for many years. Both my guests today are based at Stanford's Cyber Policy Center. To learn about the evolution of tech diplomacy, I first chatted with Eileen, who shared her vision of tech diplomacy and what that term actually means and how the international community can take action.
It's always a terrific pleasure to spend time with you, Ambassador Donahoe. When I first arrived in the Valley almost 3.5 years ago, one of our first port of calls was to, you know, call on you, just given your experiences in the course of your career, but also what you're up to right now. Can you tell us a little bit about the work of the Digital Policy Incubator and the Cyber Policy Center at Stanford and the role it plays in the ecosystem?
Yes, the Global Digital Policy Incubator, our mission has always been to serve as a global multi-stakeholder collaboration hub. And our aspiration has always been to bring stakeholders from different groups and from around the world together to try to develop shared visions and policies and guidelines, norms that bring a sort of democratic human rights-based normative vision into the digital realm. We are very explicitly, you know, we are driven by the norms. We look at the implication of digital technology for the enjoyment of human rights, as well as technology policy, which we have seen the regulatory moves that are made by government can also have big implications for human rights. And then we also see ourselves as advocates for this existing international human rights law framework.
Eileen got involved in the tech policy dialogue as a result of her diplomatic work at the UN Human Rights Council, which built on her extensive background in law.
So for me, it's sort of been there from the beginning. Being in Silicon Valley when I went to law school, I was already immersed in the tech environment, but I was thinking about international law and did a lot of study on transnational law, public international law, international human rights law. And then I went and became a tech litigator for a bit early in my career. So it was already planted in my mind that those two things, there was an interplay between them. But about a little more than a decade ago, during the first term of the Obama administration, I had the opportunity to go to Geneva to serve as the U.S. ambassador to the UN Human Rights Council, where we had a whole gigantic portfolio of, you know, the whole world was our portfolio, really, in terms of country-specific human rights situations and the whole range of thematic human rights issues. But at that moment, it was really the height of the internet freedom movement. It was the Arab Spring and the founding of the Freedom Online Coalition all happened in that phase. And it was a moment of optimism about the potential of technology as a liberating force in society. We thought it was inherently beneficial, and that civil society actors and dissidents and human rights activists would be the beneficiaries of technology to escape the repression of authoritarian governments. And we thought at that time, very naively, that authoritarians would never catch up.
She astutely pointed out that a lot has changed since that time.
What we have seen since then is that authoritarians have not only caught up, but they've become masters themselves of utilizing digital technologies for repressive purposes, whether it is, you know, not just mass surveillance, but ubiquitous surveillance of every aspect of people's lives and algorithmic filtering of information that's to restrict what's accessible, algorithmic promotion of propaganda, even use of AI to evaluate people's social behavior and their economic activity. And it's just using technology in all its forms to give citizens a sense that you are being watched, you are being controlled, and we will know when you step out of line because the machines are watching. And then we've also seen this other, you know, bizarre trend of internet shutdowns, you know, blunt force shutdown of communication on the internet in countries around the world, including many democracies, especially around elections or certainly during protests. And think about the dependence of people on the internet now, the so-called internet, which is our infrastructure, really, our communications infrastructure, and all of our infrastructure is now connected to this larger system. And so the ability to just shut it down is really potent. So we've seen a dramatic swing of this pendulum from naive optimism about the benefits of technology and to whom they would redound. And now we're on the other side of the equation. And my real aspiration is to be someone who helps bring us back to a middle place where we are all pushing to make sure we capitalize on the benefits of technology, which are still there and they're essential if we're going to be solving the problems in the 21st century. But we have to simultaneously figure out how do we protect against all of those downside risks. And that's the trick.
Eileen wasn't the only one to notice the changing ecosystem. Maricha Shakta was in the center of international tech policy conversations that took place over the last decade in the European Parliament.
Well, the journey of being interested in technology started before I was elected to the European Parliament. I studied new media at the University of Amsterdam, and it was really this time where that minor at the time, so subset of fields that one could study, was only just being stood up. So the internet was relatively new. Questions of globalization and what it would mean were, you know, actively debated. And that's the time that really, you know, anchored some of the questions about what does the technology mean for us people, for people in other parts of the world. Practically, I also, you know, used new technologies to discover and to campaign with. And so it's always been part of what I cared about, but with an emphasis on how we could make sure that outcomes were better for more people. So I've also strongly focused on human rights issues, foreign affairs, and one of the first things that happened when I was just elected in 2009 were the uprisings in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Green Revolution, the Arab uprisings. And so a lot of the first 5 years, which is one term in the European Parliament, I spent on understanding not only how technologies were helping dissidents and activists, but also how technologies were used by the very repressive states, you know, that we may have considered as not as advanced when it came to technologies, but who were perfectly capable of finding, hacking, tracing, exfiltration tools to go after those who dared to be critical. And so I realized early on in my political service that we needed to work to make sure that these technologies were going to deliver good outcomes and not just blindly trust the promise that they would have this, you know, liberalizing effect as long as people would have mobile phones in their hands. It was a slightly naive promise that was quite popular at the time. And unfortunately, I think we're still paying the price for the lack of realism and focus on actual rule of law solutions at the time.
Maybe you could just describe, like, what was the reaction of your colleagues and how were governments interacting with you when you were bringing this new agenda to the surface, along with some of your other colleagues?
Well, I remember well that when there were initial demonstrations happening in Tunisia, it was right around our Christmas holiday, New Year's holiday season. And so a lot of people had sort of checked out from the global news. And, you know, I would engage with citizens, journalists on social media. And there I noticed, wait, something's going on in Tunisia. And the great thing about Twitter, especially then when it was much less hateful, it was more of a community spirit, was that you could start following and listening to people who were on the ground. And so I realized there was an uprising in the making, or at least there was, you know, big social unrest. And that technology in a sort of, you know, it's a bad metaphor because it makes it sound so small, but this sort of cat and mouse phenomenon where activists were using technology in new ways, but the Ben Ali regime was also using technology to repress. And so I wrote an op-ed for Dutch media then that we should have, you know, a focus on making sure that the EU had a position and making sure that the, you know, human rights were respected also in the tech context. And a lot of my colleagues, when I was trying to raise these points in parliament, would sort of think, oh, well, technology, well, I guess it's about Facebook. Yeah, my grandchildren use Facebook. And, you know, there wasn't always an appreciation for the geopolitical dimensions. And of course, that gradually changed with, you know, big events like the WikiLeaks release of diplomatic cables, which I think was kind of a wake-up call to foreign ministries around the world. The revelations by Edward Snowden, but also the increasingly popular use by citizens around the world of social media and other technologies, and how, you know, it changed relationships of power. And I think we had every reason to take that shift in power dynamics seriously and to make sure that, you know, we would help foster democracy and freedom. But I think maybe too much time, well, I'm actually increasingly convinced too much time was lost letting these technologies sort of run their course without putting up rules of the road to make sure that they would actually, you know, enable freedoms and not willingly or unwillingly restrict them, which is, I think, a reality that we have to reckon with right now.
So what took us off course? Eileen shares some thoughts.
First limitation I have to acknowledge is that the post-World War II international order was based on a framework of sovereign nation states defined by territorial boundaries. And the internet, the global internet, the inherent trans-border mode of operation of the internet and digital technologies more generally is on its face a challenge to that concept. And so one of the innovations we need is more governance innovations that are about what happens in that trans-border space, because it cannot be that each government creates its own sovereign rules and that's the end of the story, because so much is happening now in the trans-border context where we're all affecting each other. And some of that is malign actors reaching across border, and we need to figure out how do we hold malign actors accountable for those kinds of activities in the cyber realm? But it's also the trans-border effect of regulation. You know, things like the right to be forgotten, where the early concept with that idea was that in France or in the European context, if a government said, no, you have the right to have that information taken down about you, you have the right to be forgotten. And oh, by the way, we want to demand and require that, let's say, of Google globally. That means France or whichever European government is having a global effect, where in another context like the United States, I will say, you would never have that right to be forgotten in the same way. And so it's in a weird way viewed as affecting the access to information of citizens outside the border of those countries. We need new thinking around how to address this trans-border effect. It's the nation-state boundary and the fact that so much happens in that middle ground, and we don't quite have a regulatory concept that works. And then the second thing I'll quickly mention is this idea of multi-stakeholder engagement, which is relatively new. And I also think goes with that other place, because we're no longer talking about sovereign states that are ideally democratic and accountable to their citizens. You now have a so-called global situation with trans-border effects. And in the earlier generation of the international system, it was pretty much a state-based policy realm. It was multilateral policy development and diplomacy, where it's only state to state and the power dynamics between states. And this idea of multi-stakeholder engagement is one way to address what you might call the democracy deficit in that international policy realm. It's not citizens of a state defined by territorial boundaries. It's citizens and civil society actors of the world who claim that they are impacted by the decisions, and that the governments and the regulatory moves that are made have to reflect their interests. And that's why they deserve a seat at the table. So that's an evolving innovation in the international governance realm as well.
This concept of sovereignty and the citizen and multi-stakeholder engagement also came up with Maricha, who advocates for fact-based policy as a way forward.
Well, you know, there's a lot of talk about sovereignty these days. The Chinese want to be sovereign, Europeans now want to be tech sovereign, but the most important sovereign in a democracy is, of course, the citizen. And that citizen, when they interact with technology, has become seen more and more as a consumer of technology, treated as a consumer, which, of course, really limits the freedoms and the agency that they have vis-a-vis big corporations. And so, one, the public interest, public values need to be elevated. Two, practical steps have to be taken to make sure that there's more transparency and access to information so that both the public can learn the same type of lessons about AI that people in labs and companies can, but also so that journalists can ask critical questions of what is actually going on under the hood, so that lawmakers can make evidence and fact-based policies, which, you know, so much information is now shielded from them because of trade secrets and other kinds of protections, that it's really hard to have a foundation to build solid laws on, but also access to information as a precondition to know whether your rights are respected or violated, as a precondition for independent oversight, and as a precondition for accountability. I think the accountability gap is one of the biggest problems when it comes to tech in our societies. We can read every day these days about ransomware attacks on hospitals, about data thefts or leaks, or, you know, other kinds of mismanagement of people's most sensitive information, you know, and then consequentially they can be approached by criminals with more sophistication for phishing and other kinds of attacks. Hardly ever is anyone held to account. We now have states intruding in unprecedented ways. You've seen the SolarWinds hack in the United States, the Exchange server hack. For a while, there was talk about escalation. Right now, there is escalation on a daily basis, and there's very, very little consequence. So this impunity has to stop. And I think that, you know, together with rules like antitrust to make sure that there's fairness in the economy, this should lead to more fairness and upholding of the idea of justice also when it comes to digital aspects of people's lives.
Maricha and Eileen both agree that people need to come first. While international cooperation is crucial, it's not always that simple. For instance, North American and European approaches to policy vary greatly, and they could be headed in different directions. Where do you see the biggest divides across the Atlantic right now? You mentioned prior administrations, but others have focused on just a fundamental difference of approach. And some suggest that, you know, the European Union's taking a hard law approach to a number of these challenges. And the U.S. has preferred soft law in many different contexts. And how do you see these differences right now? And where do you see as some of the potential bridges for it?
I mean, there are a lot of differences that remain. Indeed, what you mentioned, this libertarian approach that is quite typical in the United States, but also a much more strong focus on national security. I'm always amazed at how proud Americans are that they have small government, unless it is about national security. It's incredible how much power and agency people are willing to give to the authorities. And so the emphasis on national security is much stronger in the United States. Obviously, the market is much stronger in the United States. American tech companies together have more market capitalization than the stock markets of all EU member states, plus the UK and Switzerland combined. So the economic force, you know, both as a part of the economy, but also in terms of, you know, the ability for them to lobby the administration, to influence the debate in the United States, should not be underestimated. Whereas in Europe, there's much less of a focus on national security. And I think sometimes this can be to their detriment. There is much more focus on fundamental rights like data protection, the respect for privacy, you know, the questions about how to safeguard the democratic process, to protect minorities. And so, in some sense, you would hope you could add them up and divide them in two and you would get a much better balance. And then there's also areas where there's actually quite a lot of convergence. I'm thinking about antitrust, where a number of very similar cases are approached very similarly. And so I can imagine collaboration there. There's aspirations to drive a democratic coalition on both sides, a global coalition to foster tech governance with a, you know, clear democratic anchor. There are challenges that are shared with a more assertive China and debates about how far we should go or America is willing to go when it comes to decoupling, the extent to which it wants to push Europe, the challenge that Europeans have with very different approaches to China. Some countries keen to take the relatively cheap loans and investments, others deeply worried about the influence of authoritarianism and techno-authoritarianism, the difference between having a land border or being, you know, an ocean away. There are a lot of differences in how threats and opportunities are being perceived. And so I think there's a lot of work to be done still, for sure.
Eileen observed a similar divide, but pointed to Canada as an important voice in the multilateral dialogue.
Interestingly, I think players like Canada can play a really important role right now, because I think the dynamic between Europe and the United States is at a pretty unhealthy juncture. And, you know, I have to acknowledge that, you know, we just had a presidency that was, I will say, devastating for our country, devastating for our alliances with our democratic partners, and devastating with respect to the U.S. role in the world more generally. You can't overstate how detrimental Donald Trump was to U.S. stature and the health of our relationships around the world. So some of it is really understandable, but I think that it's a moment where, unfortunately, while we've been in tension with each other and our relationships have been deteriorating, and democratic governments have been somewhat confused about how they simultaneously protect the values they claim to protect, they haven't succeeded. It's basically what it comes down to. There are so many security threats associated with digital technology that many governments are sort of throwing out the liberty side of the equation and imposing regulations in ways that are sort of trending toward what authoritarians would do. But the bottom line is we've been inwardly focused and we have been focused on the malign exploitation of digital technology and focused on the technology companies themselves. And we have taken our eye off the much larger global dynamic, which is this rising authoritarianism, particularly through technology dominance and role modeling utilization of technology for increasingly repressive purposes, export of the technology, and advocacy for concepts like cyber sovereignty, which ultimately come down to some variation of we get to do whatever we want with technology within our own cyber borders, and you don't get to criticize us on human rights grounds. And there's basically this entire trend saying the authoritarian model is better suited to the 21st century digital context, and the world should come with us. And my view is that is the problem we must all be focused on. And this is where Canada can play such an important role, because the US and we have this transatlantic rift over technology. This past summer, the European Court of Justice struck down the data sharing arrangement between the United States and Europe. It was negotiated in the Obama administration at the end. It's called Privacy Shield. And it really undercuts the ability, digital trade between Europe and the United States. And instead, what we really need to be doing is banding together. We need to be pooling our data, pooling our technology investments, thinking about how we can together win in the technology battle, which ultimately is the only way we can win in the normative battle, from my point of view. You can't think of ourselves as being able to control what happens in the governance realm if you don't have any real role in the technology side. So however complicated it sounds, these things must go together. Technological innovation and leadership on our norms and global influence, they go together. And I really think we need to see ourselves as a larger values-driven alliance again. And I think Canada is strong on both sides of the equation, both in appreciating the value of the technology and in fully embracing the responsibility to live up to our values.
It's clear that innovation and societal values need to come together. Marietje described this important union as a tactic to combat rising digital authoritarianism.
Well, for that, I believe scale and a level playing field is important to make sure that there is as much convergence in as significant enough as possible of the space. So that's why countries like India are such almost, I would say, battleground states, which is maybe the wrong word to say, but they are countries whose alliance will be crucial because of their scale, because of their tech capacity. And I believe that these types of new collaborations between democracies, Japan also being very active in this space for years already, are going to be really important. And so outreach not only between long-standing partners where a lot of agreements have already been made, for example, with Canada, we have a trade agreement with the EU, but also to those countries where there's not such established collaboration, to really focus on the tech governance question and see what countries need, and also make them aware of the risk of quick and less expensive infrastructure, which has been, you know, a trap that many European countries stepped into, that many developing countries are stepping into, but, you know, where cheap becomes pricey very, very quickly.
Co-literacy in technology is crucial here. And Marietje explains how governments can support efforts to transfer more power to citizens through education and access.
How do you see this trend towards governments actually, you know, promoting and supporting this idea of building capacity in diplomacy, which is particularly tech literate?
Well, it's crucial. Tech literacy is crucial across governments in diplomacy, but also elsewhere, because technology is not a topic, it's a layer. So whether people are making agriculture policy or transport policy or education policy, digitization and understanding technology will have to be a part of that. So I'm really excited that in a couple of weeks, we're starting with an executive education module at Stanford that has been designed exclusively for politicians and policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic. And I know there are some Canadian participants too, to try to inform them better about the latest technologies. And so I believe it's a task that every organization should take seriously. And I hope that for the diplomats like yourself and your colleagues, and I had the pleasure of meeting, I think, almost all of them this week, both the global set of tech ambassadors and the European set of tech ambassadors, and now you personally. So I hope that there's a clear understanding of what is about trade and investment, you know, which is a task for some of these diplomats. But what is also about policy and making sure that the national interest is promoted and protected in light of the huge power that a lot of the companies in Silicon Valley have. It's not without reason that so many of you are stationed in Silicon Valley, because, you know, theoretically, this whole tech governance agenda is a global one. And I just hope that also by working together well, there can be interpretation almost, you know, back to your capitals, back to your ministries of foreign affairs about what it is that's going on in Silicon Valley, not just as, you know, shiny example of hyper innovation, but also in terms of what lessons do we not want to copy? What are real risks coming out of Silicon Valley? You know, if Silicon Valley, you live there too, if it's a petri dish of a high-tech society, you will find plenty of really, really bad outcomes of the experiment, you know, huge inequality, lower social upward mobility, lack of access to education, poor infrastructure, and I'm sure a big fallout of the COVID pandemic, where, you know, people who were least economically empowered paid a huge price with their health. And so, yeah, I think for diplomats, there's a lot of work to do, but I hope it will not be mostly focused on sort of promoting startups from the home country.
Eileen points out there are some promising and exciting platforms for action going on in the private sphere too.
Private sector as governing actor, you know, that's a new concept, but I think that has also become quite visible. So one of the most well-known experiments in that space is the Facebook Oversight Board. It's an independent organization, and there are independent actors who are part of the board evaluating the decisions made by the private sector company with respect to its own platform. I'm not going to say it's perfect. I mean, the big critique there is that the mandate of the oversight board was bounded in a way that it's not really addressing what many people consider to be the big issue, which is the power of algorithmic promotion and demotion, the so-called gray zone, where something's not illegal and it's not violative of the community guidelines or terms of service, but the algorithmic tweak, you know, the algorithm is sort of pushing it or pulling it back in ways that are not transparent to the users or to citizens. And yet that algorithmic effect is consequential for society. I mean, that's the big challenge. But with respect to the community guidelines and application of the defined rules, that independent oversight board is a really interesting governance innovation. Well, here's another obvious example, probably the earliest example, is ICANN, the entity that establishes the protocols and keeps the system of domain name protocols running around the world, was the original multi-stakeholder internet governance body. And it was dependent upon the engagement of technologists from around the world to come to agreement about what were the best protocols and what was the best optimal approach to solving a technological problem related to interoperability. And that model worked really well for that purpose. And I think there's been growing awareness that even some of the issues that ICANN takes up move into sort of political questions rather than technical questions, but they're still sorting them out through this multi-stakeholder process. I think the big question is whether multi-stakeholder processes, what will they look like if they are affecting the policymaking by states? In a democracy, in theory, you've got representative government and you've got, you know, in theory, citizens are giving input all the time. Obviously, that there's tremendous gap between our aspiration there and the reality in the current moment. That's what we've all become aware of. But in the multilateral realm, the tradition has been that it's dynamics between states. And yet, you know, I had a call already earlier today about how to enhance really more formalized even multi-stakeholder engagement in UN processes like the open-ended working group on ICTs and international security, which is one little, you know, policy development in the UN cyber norms realm. And, you know, that's an initiative. Like, how do we enhance the role of the multi-stakeholder sector in those kinds of dynamics? All of these things are evolving, but a lot of work to do.
Marietje also highlights some exciting projects and underscores that in order to actually achieve these critical milestones towards diplomatic solutions, the international community needs to work together.
Well, it's incredible how many legislative proposals have been presented in the last year alone. So maybe listeners have heard about the Digital Services Act, which seeks to spell out more explicitly what is expected in terms of liability and responsibility with platform companies. There's a Digital Markets Act, which makes clear what gatekeepers are expected to do to meet competition standards to keep the market fair beyond just the classical and crucial antitrust rules. But there's also a Democracy Action Plan, which explicitly looks at how to make sure that elections and media can do their work freely and the trust is retained. There is an AI Act that has just been presented. So on the one hand, I'm really excited about, you know, the steps that are being taken to make sure that fundamental rights and core principles like antitrust are indeed protected. On the other hand, I worry a little bit about how all these different pieces of the puzzle will eventually fit together. It's, you know, risky to have a more fragmented set of policies instead of, you know, a joint set of them. And, you know, I also hope that the EU will be able to move quickly enough when it comes to the geopolitical aspects of all these technological developments. There's a lot going on in the EU. We all have a lot going on in our societies, but the geopolitical angle is so important that I hope that that can get some more attention and ambitious action to be realized.
There's great hope on the horizon as younger generations join the conversation and work to build a more equitable future.
Well, it's probably one of the main reasons why I came to Stanford, which is I was excited to try to see what we could teach, which is what I'm doing now, about the rule of law, about institutions, about, well, the public interest within which technology will have to live and will have to consider others. And I'm completely in agreement that younger generation students that I meet are idealistic, driven. They also see what went wrong with some of the big tech companies, and I think they're motivated to do it differently. What is challenging is that it's harder for them to find competing jobs in the public sector. They often leave university with enormous debt, and so the pool to go into a big tech corporation, after all, even if it's not aligned with their ideals, is also extraordinary. So hopefully in the capitals, and when they're listening now, there could be some consideration for that too. Like, where do we want talents to go and how can we create the conditions to also be able to have, you know, the best and the brightest computer scientists choose to serve in public office and actually have appealing opportunities to do just that?
According to Eileen, the answer lies not in writing new frameworks, but looking to our old ones and applying them in new ways.
I am a true believer. I think our values are enduring. Our principles are enduring. I turn to the international human rights law framework because so many reasons, but those founding documents were crafted in the aftermath of World War II, you know, real global crisis of epic proportions. It was a very special moment of coming together that was triggered by just horrific crisis. You know, I see it as enduring values that were put into what I consider an original text in those founding documents. And we don't need new values or new original texts. What we need is new articulation of how to apply those values in a radically transformed context. This is the disruption, you know, that every aspect of our society has been so-called disrupted, the cliche. Our governing concepts have been disrupted and our processes have been disrupted. And we need to rearticulate what does it look like to adhere to our values in this radically changed context. And so that's where governance innovation has to come in to meet the technological innovation that we've experienced.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. We hope you were able to walk away from today's episode with some new perspectives. One of my takeaways from today's conversation is tech diplomacy doesn't come in one-size-fits-all packages, and governments around the world need to move with some speed and flexibility to tackle digital authoritarianism. They need to invent some new platforms and some new standards, and revitalize some old ones. Today's conversation makes clear the role of countries like Canada as potential bridges between the United States and Europe. It also points to not only creating new institutions, but using old ones in creative ways, and building co-literacy between the public and the private sector. As we move away from a world that prizes disruption and towards a future of technology that works for humans, this kind of adaptable, fast-moving diplomacy will be crucial to incentivize healthy innovation and prevent misuse. If you want to learn more about the Canadian tech landscape and the relationship between government and the private sector, we've included some resources in the show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Eileen Donahoe and Maricha Shakta for being my guests. Production thanks to Wade Wallerstein, Kate Walter, Yves Beaulieu, Steph Colburn, Sophie Shin, and Ali Sirwa. I'm Rana Sarkar, and thank you for listening. Until next time.